Well, happy Sabbath once again to all who are listening on the webcast. Over the last four Sabbaths, we have been averaging just under 50 connections each week. It was actually over 50 until last week, and we also had a bit of a technical glitch right in the middle of the service where we lost the connection for a couple of 3 minutes, and we're not sure if some dropped off at that point because it was lower last week than it had been. But using the rule of thumb for such groupings, which is anywhere from 2 to 2.5 people per connection, we estimate, that means we're averaging about 100 to 125 in virtual attendance each week over the last four Sabbaths, which is more people than we have for the three congregations that I am aware are watching the webcast each week: Cleveland, Ohio, Meadville, Pennsylvania, and St. John's, Newfoundland, the extreme eastern part of Canada. And that would be, of course, if each one of those three had a perfect attendance, which pretty much never happens. And there's almost always somebody who misses for some reason. Now, it's just fine that we have more people than we would think for an average watching and listening in. We're certainly happy to have you. Welcome to our visitors. And once again, happy Sabbath to all of you. Today marks the fifth Sabbath for Church of God Worldwide Association congregations in the United States to have local webcasts each week. Of course, the 3 weeks before that started, there were webcasts from headquarters, so today will be the eighth headquarters webcast when they start at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 Central to them. And as you heard a little while ago, an official announcement will be forthcoming today from McKinney, Texas, on the headquarters webcast regarding the earliest date that has been set, has been determined by the administration, for Kagwa congregations to resume in-person services, understanding that some areas with more severe situations health-wise or outbreak of coronavirus or government restrictions in some cases, we'll need to wait a bit longer yet, but that will be announced in the webcast from headquarters today. What is our target date to resume in-person services for Church of God Worldwide Association? You know, there have been, as you heard in the first message today already, many lessons for us all to glean, and you certainly were handed a laundry list of important ones this morning in the first message, and I want to thank Mr. Pavlik for that. During this trying time, we should be learning lessons lickety-split, if I can use an old Southern Missouri expression from growing up in the Ozarks. Like all opportunities, though, for learning for human beings, I'm sure it's true that we pick up some and we miss others. That's just the way it is being human. The question is, how can we come up with a plan for maximizing the lessons taken advantage of and minimizing the missed opportunities? That's what we really want to try to do. And that's the topic for the second split sermon today. I want to start into the topic by borrowing an approach from a good friend, a spiritual brother, and a colleague in the ministry whose name you all know. And that's our Foundation Institute instructor, David M. Johnson. I give the middle initial to distinguish him from R. David Johnson, an elder in Fort Worth, Texas, who happens to be my actual brother, as all of you know. Then I want to go to two of the most famous incidents from the life of the prophet Elijah. My wife and I stood last June on the very place where the first incident happened on our amazing tour of Israel last year. Now, as we look back on it, in the midst of what we're in now, we say how much more incredible it was that we were able to go and do the things we were able to go and do. We may have been closer at that time than we even knew to wherever the location was for the second of these two amazing events that happened in Elijah's life. Mr. David Johnson, the FI instructor, has written an article that should be appearing in the next issue of Discern. The proposed title of the article is Debriefing, Preparing for a Spiritual Crisis. And the connection from that article to us, and then later from the one Elijah incident, if I can put it that way, to the second Elijah incident, is what I want to ask you to think about today. Today is turning out to be a service of posing thoughtful questions, and I hope to add to those questions today. I think you'll find that there's quite an amazing tie-in, even in some actual words quoted from the Scriptures in the two messages today. And there was no collusion. I didn't call him and say, "What are you talking about today?" And he didn't say, "I don't know. What are you talking about today? I'll try to tromp all over it and use up all your Scriptures." That didn't happen. So quoting from this article that's coming out, Mr. Johnson writes, "In 2001, my wife and I had the opportunity to participate in the Community Emergency Response Team training in our area, CERT for short. This program has the goal of training citizen volunteers to effectively assist first responders in a community-wide emergency. Volunteers are trained in advanced first aid skills, light search and rescue techniques, fire suppression, setting up first aid stations, how to triage victims so those needing immediate care are identified and transported, logistics, and a host of other skills that most would never consider. Training volunteers to handle some of these basic responsibilities frees first responders to use their more advanced skills where they are most needed. As our training program, which lasted several weeks, neared its end, those of us participating were required to take part in a carefully constructed disaster simulation, followed by a debriefing with the first responders themselves. Sitting through the classes, many of which involved hands-on training, we felt we were being well prepared for whatever emergencies might arise. But nothing teaches as effectively as the disaster simulation, when we had to analyze the situation and make decisions in real time without anyone telling us what to do. The debriefing with the professionals was one of the most helpful and sobering parts of the entire program. While they did their best to be encouraging, it was clear that many of us in the class had made serious mistakes that could have cost lives, our own or others. The humbling realization of our failure to see and properly assess the hidden dangers taught us in ways the classroom presentations never could. While it's easy to be critical of the mistakes people make in times of crisis, taking the time to examine errors and formulate a plan for improvement is much more helpful, and that's where debriefing can help. Debriefing presents an opportunity for people who have shared an experience or a project to self-correct, to share lessons learned, discuss what went well, and consider opportunities for improvement. Even when everything has gone well, there are often ways to improve and be more effective in the future. While it may not always be as effective as a group debriefing, it's often helpful for us to ask ourselves many of the same questions so we can recognize and avoid the unexpected dangers life brings our way. That's the end of the quote for now, which is basically the introduction to his article. I will certainly hope that you will be having your appetite for it whetted, and we'll look forward to reading it when it comes out soon. Let me ask you at this point, can you see where his article might be heading? I imagine you can, into a spiritual analogy that ought to be especially clear to us based on what we're all going through right now. And I think you can probably see how this ties into the first message today. In the article, Mr. Johnson makes two key points in the form of basic mistakes in thinking that are common to every human being, you and me included. First mistake, we think we know more than we do, and we think God knows less than he does. Now, you may be sitting there thinking, wait a minute, not me. What was that nursery tale or children's story where not I said the pig? Well, in this case, we might be saying that to ourselves. But think about it and turn back to Isaiah 55 as you think about it. That was his point. We think we know more than we do, and we think God knows less than he does. It's not that we mean to impugn God's sovereignty or speak down about him. That's not the point. The point is we don't have a full grasp of just how all-knowing He is. That's the point. We tend to think we know more than we do, that we have a bigger and more complete picture than we actually do, and we have no comprehension of just how complete His picture is. In Isaiah 55, in verse 6, these verses that we're very familiar with, I'm sure, seek the Eternal while He may be found. Call upon Him while He is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Eternal, and He will have mercy on him and to our God, for He will abundantly pardon. Then verse 8, for my thoughts are not your thoughts. Here are the key words. Nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. So that's the first thing as we head into a kind of a spiritual debriefing session. We want to drive home into our minds. Even for us, those who are the called out ones, those who have God's Spirit, maybe we've been trying to use that Spirit as God's help and power to live by for decades. But even so, it is a human proclivity to think we know more than we actually do. And it is also a human proclivity, while the wording may trouble us at first, it is a human proclivity to think God knows less than He does. Not because we're calling into question specifically anything about Him, but just because we just can't even begin to grasp how much He knows and how clear His picture is. If we read verses that talk about the fact that He knows how many hairs are on the head of every human being alive, which is somewhere between 7.5 and 8 billion people. Granted, some of us make the count simpler than others, but He still knows all of that. And He's not even sweating. He's not even breaking a sweat to know that. That ought to teach us something from a scriptural reference. We have no comprehension of how much He knows. The second barrier to learning that was related in this article is the belief that we already know all that we need to know. And I'd like to tie it back to his example of the CERT training. As he said, the classes made them all feel that they were pretty well prepared to handle an emergency that would come up until they got to the disaster simulation. And then they had to make decisions in real time with nobody to turn to for advice. And he said it was very humbling to realize that pretty much all of them were making crucial mistakes that in a real situation might have cost lives. They didn't know, not really know, all they thought they needed to know. And brethren, that's also a human proclivity. Turn to the 26th chapter of Proverbs. Mr. Pavlik had us turning to the 26th chapter of Proverbs, and I was holding my breath, but he went to different verses. It's okay, we can use the same ones if we need to. Proverbs chapter 26 and verse 12. It says, do you see a man wise in his own eyes? Isn't that what we've just said? The greatest barrier to learning is the belief that we already know all we need to know. Isn't that sort of the same as seeing somebody wise in his own eyes? Okay, I got this covered. I got this. Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? But look at the last half of the proverb. There is more hope for a fool than for him. Ouch. Ouch. The problem is, folks, as human beings, we don't know what we don't know. You know? That's the problem. If we're not aware of something, we're not aware that we're not aware of it. We used to hear years ago a statement about how is it possible for the entire world to be deceived? So many of them are such good people. And the statement was made, a deceived person doesn't know he's deceived, or otherwise he wouldn't be deceived. When we believe we already know all that we need to about a certain situation. We're just not even aware of what we don't know. We are, to use a strict definition of the word, we are ignorant. It's not intended in a pejorative sense. It just means we don't know. How's this for tying both points together? Turn to Micah chapter 6. This is possibly a memory verse for many of us. I hope so. At least you'll recognize it when you hear it. Micah 6 and verse 8. He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Eternal require of you? But to do justly, to love mercy, or loving kindness, some possible translations, and to walk humbly with your God. You know, that gets right to the heart of the matter, doesn't it? To do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. In some ways, that phrase is just restating some of the key points you heard in the first message today. But you know, even in the most dedicated of lives, we all lose sight of some basic principles at times because we are human. And that's where Elijah comes in. Turn first to the book of James, just to give us a perspective. Remember, this was written many generations after Elijah's death. By James, who was the half-brother, one of the half-brothers of Jesus Christ. And in chapter 5 of the book of James, in making a point after the explanation of the practice of being anointed for illness in the church by the ministry, he makes a comparison about this business of fervent and effective prayer that he talked about in verse 16. And in verse 17, James writes, James 5:17, Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed earnestly that it would not rain. And it did not rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months. And he prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth produced its fruit. Now, I'm not aware of any of us in this modern age who have had that kind of response to our prayers. To go out and say, God, please stop the rain for 3.5 years. Boom. Drought. Until, in our case, late in 2023. I just don't think that's going to happen. But notice the most important part of this passage for us right now, because now we're going to look at another example of Elijah's. And we want to keep in mind this part. He was a man with a nature like ours. An outstanding servant of God. An amazing servant of God. We're going to look, first of all, at another example of his prayers being answered in a spectacular, dramatically visible, undeniable way. Followed by, oops, an oops moment. And we need to remember he was a man with a nature like ours. Turn back then to 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings chapter 18. Very, very powerful section, one we've no doubt read before. I won't go into the background. There is a reference in the very first verse of the chapter to the fact that this 3.5 year period of drought with no rain was about to end. But the setting is the terrible spiritual condition of the land of Israel under King Ahab and his Phoenician wife Jezebel. I'm not going to go through all the detail of that. The first part of the chapter is actually quite interesting, where Elijah tells Obadiah, who's a servant in the king's household, to go tell the king that I want to see him. And Elijah had apparently disappeared more on occasion before, and they couldn't find him. And nobody could find him for months at a time. And Obadiah basically says, "Oh, great. What have I done to you? You know, you want me to go tell Ahab? Elijah wants to meet you, and I'll tell him where, and I'll tell him when, and he'll go there, and you will have disappeared again, and I'm dead meat. What have I done so wrong?" But he does what he's asked. And let's take it down to about verse 20. We know the background that there are these prophets, 400 prophets of the groves or Asherah, and 450 prophets of Baal. 450 and 400 total makes 850. We're not told if all 850 met their end this day, but we know at least a good chunk of them did. It says in verse 20, "So Ahab sent for all the children of Israel and gathered the prophets together on Mount Carmel." My wife and I have stood there. Last June, we stood on Mount Carmel, a majestic sight, overlooking the massive valley of Megiddo. It's just, you stand there and it just takes your breath away. And then when you start considering what happened there, and you can look down and you can see the brook below, the valley itself, the brook Kishon is still down there below. You can still see the greenery where, if you were to go down closer, you would see the water moving through there. But this is a spectacular occurrence. Just keep reading. "Elijah came to all the people and said, 'How long will you falter between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him.' But the people answered him not a word. Then Elijah said to the people, 'I alone am left a prophet of the eternal, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Therefore, let them give us two bulls. Let them choose one for themselves, cut it in pieces, lay it on the wood, but no fire under it. I'll prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood, but put no fire under it. Then you call on the name of your gods, and I will call on the name of the eternal God, the ever-living one, the one who has life inherent within himself.'" That's the tetragrammaton, the YHWH or YHVH that couldn't even be pronounced. And the God who answers by fire, he is God." So all the people answered and said, "Well spoken." Now Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose one bull for yourselves. Prepare it first, for your many. You call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it." No cheating, he said. So they took the bull which was given them, and they prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning even till noon, saying, "O Baal, hear us." I still hear the chant from the oratorio. Elijah, whenever I read this verse, I can hear it in my head. "But there was no voice. No one answered. Then they leaped about the altar which they had made. And so it was at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, 'Cry aloud,' or 'Cry with a loud voice. He's a god. Either he's meditating, or he's busy, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's sleeping and must be awakened." What a god that would be. "So they cried aloud and cut themselves, as was their custom, with knives and lances until the blood gushed out on them. And when midday was past, they prophesied until the time of the evening sacrifice. But there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention." Well, of course, we know that because there are no other gods. "Then Elijah said to all the people, 'Come near to me.' So all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord that was broken down. And Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Eternal had come, saying, 'Israel shall be your name.' One who prevails with God is what it meant. Then with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar large enough to hold 2 seahs of seed. And he cut the wood in order, or he put the wood in order, I should say, cut the bull in pieces, laid it on the wood, and said, 'Fill 4 water pots with water. Pour it on the burnt sacrifice and on the wood.'" Well, the sacrifice that was to be burned, it of course was not yet. "Then he said, 'Do it a second time.' And they did it a second time. And he said, 'Do it a third time.' And they did it a third time. So the water ran all around the altar. He also filled the trench with water. And it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, 'Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, Let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Hear me, O Lord, I pray. Hear me, that this people may know that you are the Lord God, and you have turned their hearts back to you again. Then the fire of the Eternal fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice, the wood, the stones, the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. Now, what kind of a fire do you know that can do that? Now, when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces. They said, "The Eternal, He is God. The Eternal, He is God." We might have said, "Big surprise." But for them, apparently it was. And Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape." So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon, down the hill, we've seen it, and executed them there. And Elijah said to Ahab, "Go up, eat and drink. There is the sound of abundance of rain." Remember, there had been none for 3.5 years. So Ahab went up to eat and drink, and Elijah went up to the top of Carmel. There he bowed down on the ground and put his face between his knees and said to his servant, "Go up now and look toward the sea." That's one direction from the top of the hill. You can, on a clear day, you can see the Mediterranean. So he went up and looked and said, "There's nothing." And 7 times he said, "Go again." And it came to pass the 7th time, he said, "There's a cloud as small as a man's hand rising out of the sea." So he said, "Go say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down before the rain stops you." A cloud the size of a man's hand rising out of the sea. And he says, "You better get moving or you're not going to make it back." Now it happened in the meantime that the sky became black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy rain. So Ahab rode away and went to Jezreel. Then the word of the Eternal came upon Elijah, and he girded up his loins and ran ahead of Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. You know the verse that you heard Mr. Pavlik read? If you have wearied with the footmen, how will you run with the horses? Well, here's a case where somebody did, but again, with supernatural assistance. Now, what would you be thinking about now if you had been Elijah? I mean, you have just put to death more than half of the false prophets of the entire nation, apparently. At least the 450 prophets of Baal. It doesn't specifically say that the prophets of the groves or the Asherah were executed. We don't know. You have just halted in its tracks a method for propagating false worship. You have demonstrated the power of God. You didn't do it, but it was done through you in a miraculous and powerful way. What would you be thinking about right now at this moment? Would you at this point see any trouble on the horizon? You even indicated to your servant that he should go basically command the king, "You better get out of here. Get in your chariot and move, or you're not going to get back to the city." And he did. He, you know, ran off with his tail between his legs, as we say. The king, Ahab. Would you at that point see any possible trouble on the horizon? Or would you be thinking, "Whew, what a relief. That's taken care of now, at least for time being." We don't know if Elijah did. We don't have any time to determine that. His reaction to what happens next, though, makes us wonder. He had not apparently felt threatened by King Ahab because Ahab turned tail and ran. But it does seem, as we look at the next chapter, that maybe he could have benefited by doing a debriefing section after the events of that famous day. First question he should have asked: how is this going to go over with Ahab and Jezebel? Second question: what do I need to do about it before they start chasing me? Let's read on. Chapter 19, verse 1. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, also how he had executed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So let the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by about tomorrow this time. Or tomorrow about this time. When he saw that, I'm sure it was a shock, a bolt out of the blue. He arose and ran for his life. He went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. That was quite some distance from Mount Carmel, which is in the north and the west. And he left his servant there. Now, there is a proverb that might seem to apply here. You don't need to turn to it. I'll re-quote it to you. But when you think about it, I'm not sure it does. It sounds like it does, but it may not. It's in Proverbs 22:3. You can look it up later. It says, "A prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished." Proverbs 22:3. The contemporary English version puts it a little more bluntly. It says, "When you see trouble coming, don't be stupid and walk right into it. Be smart and hide." Well, that's pretty direct. But you know, when you think about it, that doesn't really apply here, does it? We don't have any indication Elijah saw trouble coming. It seems when he got this message from Jezebel in verse 2 of chapter 19, he panicked, just like you heard about in the first message, and he ran for his life. This wasn't a matter of thinking something through and taking steps to be hidden again. He reacted out of sheer terror for his life after he heard what Jezebel told him. Maybe he was lulled into a false sense of security by the fact that Ahab did nothing after the false prophets were executed, but Jezebel was something and someone else entirely different. So he ran. Then what? Verse 4, going on, it says, "But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness. He came and sat down under a broom tree." The margin says juniper. It's a type of a desert tree that has extremely deep roots and spreads way, way out. It was used for shade in the desert. That was the whole point. "And he prayed that he might die. And he said, 'It is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I'm no better than my father's.'" He asked God to kill him. Remember, there was someone else who did that, and that was Jonah. We have some concept of his frame of mind. "Then as he lay and slept under a broom tree, suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, 'Arise and eat.' Then he looked, and there by his head was a cake baked on coals or hot stones and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came back the second time and touched him and said, 'Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you.' So he arose and he ate and drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, the mountain of God." You bet it took a long time to get there. Look at a map. We're talking from the north in Mount Carmel on the Mediterranean coast, essentially, through the valley of Megiddo, past where Jerusalem currently is. It was just a Jebusite city early on until King David had made it his capital. But down past that into the Sinai wilderness and almost to the point where the Red Sea forks into two gulfs, the Gulf of Suez on the west and the Gulf of Aqaba, or the Gulf of Eilat, as perhaps earlier known, on the east. It's right down in that little point of the Sinai Peninsula. Long trip. And where was he going? Who was sustaining him? Who fed him supernaturally? What kind of being touched him and spoke to him twice? Verse 5 and verse 7. What is Elijah thinking now, do you wonder? Well, for a background to measure his responses against, hold your place here, please, and go to Matthew 24, verse 44 to 46. And I'll read the companion account of verses that Mr. Pavlik already read to you in the first message. Matthew 24, verse 44, it says, "Therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." That was the whole point of the first sermon today. As I heard him begin to spin that out, I thought, whoa, these two messages are really dovetailing beautifully, with no collusion involved. "Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Those are the words you already heard from the other gospel account. I believe it was Luke. Back to 1 Kings 19. Remember that phrase, so doing. 1 Kings 19:9 now, it says, "And there he went into a cave, and he spent the night in that place. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?'" I actually think that's as good a title for this sermon as any other, if you want a title. What are you doing here, Elijah? Look at his answer. "So he said, 'I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts. For the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life.'" Did that answer what he was asked? It did not. Who is he talking about in his answer? What is he talking about? Is he talking about God's power and miraculous deliverance and astonishing power to sustain him? And the destruction of false teachers who deceived the people? Not a word. Not a word. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, yours and mine. Basically, at this terrified moment, he could not see past his own troubles. Where was the recognition of what miracle God had just shown? So verse 11... "Then God says, 'Go out and stand on the mountain before the Eternal. And behold, the Eternal passed by, and a great and strong wind tore into the mountains and broke the rocks in pieces before the Lord, but he wasn't in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the voice," or after the fire, "a still, small voice." God gives him another chance. Was Elijah listening to the still small voice yet? He was not. Go on. "So it was when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and he went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. Suddenly a voice came to him and said, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?'" Same question. And he's going to get the same answer. "And he said, 'I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets with a sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life.'" God gives him another chance. And look at the key words in God's question. Pull out for the moment the two words, "are" and "doing." Because that pretty much matches "so doing" that we read in Matthew 24. Pull those words out and accent the others as you read the question. How would God's question have sounded then? "What are you doing here?" Accent on the what. Or, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Or, "What are you doing here?" Do you see what God is trying to get him to see? He's trying to get him to focus. Focus on what's important. On God's direction in his life. Did Elijah have an answer? Well, yes and no. I mean, when he repeated, when he got the repeated question in verse 13, he pretty much gave a repeated answer in verse 14. And at this point, though, God speaks to him. And it's as if Elijah, the wheels are moving now. Maybe he was doing a little debriefing, to use our analogy. Maybe he was starting to ask himself, "What did God ask me? How did I answer? Does he still have work for me to do?" And as you read the rest of the chapter, which I will leave you to do, the rest of the chapter gives us every assurance that Elijah recovered his spiritual equilibrium. That he analyzed where he was and he made changes on the spot. Because God just begins to give him a list of things he's supposed to do, starting in verse 15. And when he finished giving him that list, he adds a note of assurance in verse 18. He says, "Oh, by the way, Elijah," that's the Johnson version, Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal and every mouth that has not kissed him. Oh, by the way, Elijah, you're not alone. What was Elijah's reaction? So he departed from there. He left the cave. He came out of hiding. He said, I am going to do what God has commanded me to do. And I am going to not worry about the consequences. His debriefing session must have worked. I'd like to return to Mr. Johnson's article for just a moment. He writes late in the article, if you were to humbly turn to God's inspired word to debrief your life right now, what would you learn? What's working well and producing the right results? What's causing problems and making life more difficult? What's eating up your time and not really producing anything of lasting value? And again, hearken back to the first message and put these two together. I think you'll find they do really blend. Mr. Johnson's article goes on, and most important, what are you doing about it? For the purposes of this message, we could say, what are you doing here, Elijah? Only we need to each substitute our names. Since Elijah is a man with a nature like ours, then let's assume he, like us, has a name that he's known by, and we can put our names in there when we read God's word. What are you doing here? And put your name in. The article goes on, before the next unexpected crisis careens over the horizon, take the time to pick up the Creator's instruction book and use it. Not anyone's opinion, including your own, to debrief your life and become prepared for the days ahead. That's good advice, brethren. We are still, at least for some short time, we hope, hopefully a shorter term now, in this challenging situation. But with God's help in learning some debriefing skills spiritually to analyze our own conduct, our growth, our decisions, our direction so far in this trial and crisis, we can find opportunities for spiritual growth and sounder health. You know, early on, a few days ago, we were talking with some of the members in the congregation, one of the congregations. I won't illuminate any further than that. And we were talking about it, and of course this subject came up, but this one person said on the phone, this person said, you know, there is something that's helpful in this. The Sabbath routines are different now, but this person said, we have the chance we can listen to two or three sermons on the Sabbath and just really drink in. That's something he said, I miss, you know, fellowshipping with everybody, and I'll be so glad to get back to it. But that has been an opportunity to take advantage of too. You know, like that, we can find opportunities for spiritual growth and sounder spiritual health. Do what that person suggested. Look for spiritual openings and opportunities and find ways to learn from it all. That's a healthy case of debriefing and carrying on and staying calm, with apologies to our British friends, as we weather the storm. You know, in that context, one last reference for today maybe it gets a little easier to understand. It's in the book of James, James chapter 1. And verse 2, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect or mature and complete, lacking nothing. There can be positive results. We will have to work at it, and we'll have to ask God's help. Do you know the result when spiritual muscle gets a good spiritual workout like that, it gets stronger. With God's help, we can too.